ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesels required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid. Search for The Economy Stupid on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was Oscar Wilde who wrote, "Love is like a war. Easy to start, but hard to end."
And there's certainly no love lost between the US and Iran.
So how does their conflict finish?
Gulf states warn of a frozen war.
But is that the same as an uneasy peace? I'm Kylie Morris.
And I'm Latika Burke. This episode, Global Roaming returns to Iran. Kylie, there's a worrying familiarity to, I feel, what's taking place in Iran. The back and forth, the stop start, the will they, won't they, it all feels just like this war is starting to drag on to something a little more permanent.
Yeah, I have the same feeling actually. And I think if we call it an impasse at the moment, which is probably the right term for it, you can be misled into thinking that means actually not much is going on. But I'm really happy we've been able to find a guest who can look more deeply at the current situation and talk more not only about the endless to-ing and fro-ing of the conversations, the diplomacy, the negotiation, but also how Iranians are waiting this out, right? How the situation that they are faced with, the blockade, how do they manage that and what does it mean politically inside Iran? At the same time, what does this spinning out of the conflict mean for Donald Trump and the kind of political risk he faces because of it? We've also, you know, just recently seen a pretty significant rupture in the region with the UAE leaving OPEC. So even though the direct fighting might have stopped, the repercussions of this war are alive and developing.
And only just starting. I think this UAE OPEC move is a real symbol of just how deep the new fractures in the world order are going to be. Something we talk about a lot on Global Roaming. But I think sometimes it's incidents like this where you have to say, look, there's so much noise and there's so much chaos with the Trump administration. That ricochets around the world. But sometimes you just get these incidents that really underline the quiet changes that everyone has assessed and is calculating, and going forward show how this world will not be the same.
And it's not only the UAE, right? I mean, even the Qataris have been warning of the cost of a frozen conflict that, as they describe it, thaws into war pretty much every time there's a political reason for either side to snap back into hostilities. So this is a really uncomfortable situation. I'm interested in hearing from our guest in particular how long he imagines it can go on for.
Yes, our guest this episode is Esfandya Batmangelic. He's the founder and CEO of the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation. This is a think tank focused on economic diplomacy and development in the Middle East. Unique background. He's an American citizen of Iranian descent who lives here in London. He was previously a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and has published peer-reviewed research on Iran's political economy, social history, politics, and economics. So there's no one better to give us the full gamut of the situation in Iran. Here he is now.
Esfandya Batmangelic, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So are we getting this right? Is it right to talk about the current state of the conflict in the Middle East as neither war nor peace?
So long as the ceasefire remains in place, I think that's a fair characterization. The concern is that this limbo that we're in is unlikely to hold. The U.S. commitment to the blockade, which in reality as it is enforced, is a violation of the ceasefire, is something that is escalatory. And from the Iranian perspective, I think it's raised significant questions about the commitment of the Trump administration to finding a diplomatic solution, an off-ramp out of this war. And as the pressure mounts economically, not just on the global economy, but also on the Iranian economy, we may be facing a dynamic where the two sides end up back in the conflict if a diplomatic breakthrough does not materialize. But the question is, can the U.S. apply enough economic pressure in a short enough period of time to decisively shift the negotiations in its favor? And I think that's very unlikely because of the way in which a blockade interacts with the Iranian economy and because of some of the dynamics that are inherent to how Iran responds to economic pressure from the outside.
So how long can this current situation last?
If you ask either side, they'll tell you that, you know, this can go on forever because they have the perseverance and will be able to outlast their adversary. In reality, I think there is a sort of ticking time bomb here for the global economy. So long as the blockade is in place, Iran is not going to allow maritime shipping to return to normal through the Strait of Hormuz. And that means that the accumulated effect of the disruptions to energy exports from the Persian Gulf region, the exports of petrochemical products, the exports of all manner of manufactured goods that also leave that region, those supply chain disruptions are going to get worse. And every day that the blockade goes on, we are counting on more economic impacts for the global economy. The great irony being that among all the countries in the world, the U.S. is in some ways the least prone to feeling those costs. And that may explain why the administration is so blasé about this strategy of trying to outlast the Iranians in terms of a blockade that's responding to the Iranian blockade of the strait that began in the early days of the war. There is also the ticking time bomb question for the Iranian economy. Of course, these disruptions are significant. Iran is very dependent on sea trade through its Persian Gulf ports. And we are starting to see, in addition to the significant damage that was inflicted on industrial facilities and civilian infrastructure in Iran during the war, that the combination of trade disruptions and impacts on industrial output are being felt in Iran's economy, not least by ordinary people, because we are seeing job losses related to that impact on industrial activity.
Can't the U.S. outlast the Iranians on the economic front? I mean, not only when it comes to oil, but you've mentioned the economic needs of the Iranians, right? The imports they can't get right now, but would normally rely on through Persian Gulf ports, like raw materials, you know, spare parts, different kinds of components.
Theoretically, yes, but in practice, no. And the distinction is that ultimately, economic resilience is a political question. And Iran is a country that has had to endure significant economic deprivation for a very long time. It was actually the Trump administration, which 8 years ago imposed maximum pressure sanctions on Iran, fundamentally changing the trajectory of Iran's economic development and leading to a situation where ordinary Iranians, on average, became poorer than they otherwise would have been. This matters because in some ways, the expectations of ordinary Iranians in terms of their own economic well-being have already been negatively impacted. And this is even compounded by the experience of the war. Iran is directly experiencing the war. And so while we're in this wartime state, understandably, the political the political volatility that's associated with economic hardship is going to be less. In a way, the government can say, look, of course things are bad because we're in a war. In the U.S., it's quite different. We're facing a midterm that's coming up, and the Trump administration is also facing very low favorability ratings, largely because of mismanagement of the economy. And what we see is that in the U.S. context, if the economic costs of this war start to be felt in a more profound way, it's going to be very difficult for the Trump administration to give a reason to the American public about why they should be paying that price. Why is the price of oil and therefore the price of petrol so high? There is not really a strategic logic to waging this war, and I think that's clear among much of the American electorate, and that may be a binding constraint on how long the U.S. can persist in what is essentially a a folly in terms of its decision to attack Iran.
So when it comes to this impasse, you're saying that the political stakes are actually higher for the US?
That should be the conventional view. Now, of course, Trump is an unconventional president. And I think one of the concerning signs that we're seeing is that he seems a president uniquely uncaring about what his public thinks of him and his sort of leadership of the country. And surprisingly, we also see that his cabinet, and his vice president, so people like J.D. Vance, and in the cabinet, people like Marco Rubio, they have seemingly been unable to curtail a lot of Trump's instincts here, to take escalatory action, to assert that he's winning a war that he is clearly losing, or at least stuck in an attritional state against Iran. And to that extent, there seems to be a little bit of a breakdown in the conventional feedback loop, where if you make a bad policy decision, like starting an unnecessary war in the Middle East, and it leads to a global economic crisis, that should have an impact on whether or not your administration decides to pursue that policy, because you will start to have public dissatisfaction. But neither did this administration make those calculations at the outset of the war, which is largely why they stumbled into it. But nor do they seem to be making serious considerations about those factors at this moment. Really, the crisis that we're in raises more fundamental questions about the quality and soundness of U.S. policymaking. This is no longer a problem just related to Iran. It's really a White House that is sort of wreaking havoc. And there doesn't seem to be much in the way of guardrails in Washington to prevent the car careening off course.
I'm Kylie Morris, here with Latika Burke. You're listening to Global Roaming, and our guest today is Esfandjar Badman-Gelich.
We had President Trump on the day of Operation Epic Fury's launch telling the Iranians that they have a once-in-a-generation chance to go and seize their country back for themselves. Is the cumulative effect of the bombing, of the extra sanctions, now this blockade, what is that doing internally in Iran? I mean, there's obviously a good comparison to be made here with Russia, where I think there was a lot of hope and expectation that maybe sanctions on Russia might turn the Russian people against Putin. We're seeing the opposite effect. What's the dynamic inside Iran?
I think there remains significant frustration, dissatisfaction with the leadership in Iran. So, you know, just before the war in January, we saw historic protests that were brutally repressed. And the sentiments that led to those protests, the feeling of disenfranchisement, the frustration about Iran's kind of squandered years of development, those things haven't gone away. But they have been put into relief by the crisis that's facing the country right now: foreign aggression, unprecedented airstrikes, the threat to things like a whole civilization. And the Iranian public is sophisticated enough to be able to hold these multiple ideas at the same time, which is, you know, a great sadness in some ways that the country has reached this point, both because of failures of leadership domestically and also the ambitions of leaders abroad, let's say Bibi Netanyahu or Donald Trump. But at the same time, recognizes that at this moment, resilience is incredibly important. And what we've seen in the country is an incredible capacity at really a community level for people to stand by one another in a moment of crisis and to try and help each other out in the face of, you know, people losing their homes, people losing their jobs, people losing their lives. And I think those are the things that ultimately point to a fabric of Iranian society that is frayed but remains intact. And, you know, Iranians are still looking optimistically, I think, to a future where they can, and hoping that they will get through this crisis as they've gotten through crises before and continue that very hard work of trying to push their country towards a more just political and economic future.
So it's a solidarity effect at a communal societal level, not necessarily a rallying effect for the regime.
Exactly, Latika. I think that's a really good way of breaking it down. It's, you know, we often think that a war is going to cause this kind of rally around the flag effect. There has been some of that, of course. But the solidarity I see is more deeper than that. It's not about the Islamic Republic. It's not even necessarily about the Iranian state. But the way this war has been deliberately cast by the US and Israel is actually a war on Iranian society itself. And, you know, the decisions that were made in the public messaging, in the choice of targets, in the indiscriminate nature of a lot of the way this war was waged, you know, those are things that Iranians have seen up close. And I think it's engendered a kind of solidarity that goes far beyond just a rote nationalism and goes to something that is more fundamental. And I think encouragingly points to the fact that Iranians are not yet broken despite everything that they've gone through, that they're still trying to find a way forward. And that resilience ultimately is the thing that, at the same time, I think the leadership of the Islamic Republic, somewhat ironically, are able to look at that and say, they may get through this crisis, but it also means that they have a responsibility in their governance to also take steps in line with what the public wants. And that is ultimately why they did go to Islamabad and have direct talks with the US to try and get out of this war. It's just that that diplomacy has hit a hurdle and it may be difficult to get it back on track.
I wonder, it is hard to keep up with the ricocheting interlocutors apparently seeking to make a deal on both sides. But do you think either side actually understands what the other needs to build a lasting peace? And can you see room at this stage for any kind of mutual agreement?
Unfortunately, although I do think that the Iranian negotiators, many of whom have been working on this file for the better part of three decades. So they've been dealing with nuclear negotiations from the early 2000s and have been dealing with basically the U.S.-Iran relationship from the mid-90s. You know, they had developed, I think, a relatively good understanding of how Washington works, what Washington's concerns were with Iran from a national security perspective. The difficulty is that the learnings that they had gained don't apply with this administration. This is an administration that is really approaching diplomacy, not just in Iran, but in other contexts, Venezuela, in Gaza, with the Ukraine war, without drawing on any of the old playbooks, basically. And the approach that the administration is taking is very difficult to predict. And it also doesn't lend itself to the formulation of win-win solutions, which is ultimately the way that Iran has tried to approach this complex diplomacy at the many junctures where it has been negotiating across the table from the United States. In the Trump administration view, diplomacy is meant to be more zero-sum. That model of diplomacy is not going to work in an Iranian context. Iran is not going to accept violations of its sovereignty, and it's not going to put itself in a position where the U.S. gets to dictate terms. It will insist on basically a win-win formula, a way in which the two sides make concessions that are intended to be relatively balanced. On the Iranian side, mainly making concessions around its nuclear program and some aspects of the regional security posture that it has. On the U.S. side, making concessions around the economic pressure associated with sanctions and also around the kind of recurring threat that it has posed in trying to say that it will engage in military attacks against Iran. And therefore, there should be a formula for a deal. But you know, from the U.S. perspective, they don't seem to understand why the win-win structure of a diplomatic agreement is so important. And whether they come to this realization at some point in the next few weeks will really determine the course of this conflict. Because so long as they insist on something akin to the Venezuela model or a version of diplomacy where Trump can, you know, declare unilaterally that he was the victor and got to dictate terms, I think he will continue to hit a dead end. And I would also add that that form of diplomacy will not be sufficient to solve the complex dilemmas that have been created by this war. So we're not just talking about U.S.-Iran diplomacy, but at the end of the day, what has to be reckoned with here is the fact that the U.S. security guarantee for its allies in the Persian Gulf also failed. So the U.S. has bases in Qatar, in the UAE, in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain. It was unable to defend those countries from Iranian attacks. That is something the administration should be taking more seriously in the course of their negotiations, making sure that this is a win-win-win deal, a deal that also secures gains for the Gulf countries that are now so aggrieved. But again, that seems to be an afterthought for the administration. And so I think we should have a low degree of confidence that this U.S. team, which is really limited to Vance, Witkoff, and Kushner, can engage with the Iranians and come to a diplomatic agreement that lasts.
What is the significance of the UAE leaving OPEC?
I think the UAE leaving OPEC is a signal of the Emirates' frustrations about the way in which they were disproportionately targeted by Iran during the course of the war, and the fact that they were not able to rally their fellow Gulf countries, particularly Qatar and Saudi Arabia as the two other key players in the GCC, to take a more aggressive stance towards the Iranians. The UAE has had the most sort of distinct policy towards Iran, trying to hedge in its approach with the Islamic Republic, namely by allowing for a recovery in economic engagement with Iran. Actually, trade between the UAE and Iran has grown significantly in the last 7 years in a reflection of the UAE's growing diplomacy with Iran, which led to the normalization of relations and the reopening of embassies in both countries. And there are many figures within the Emirati leadership who feel that that strategy of engagement with Iran failed or backfired. And they are really angry, essentially, that Iran made the choice to externalize the war by attacking the Emirates and attacking the Emirates more than other countries in the Gulf. Of course, that was, I think, the strategy Iran took because the UAE is uniquely important from a kind of global economic center standpoint. So as a hub for global trade, for global aviation, for global banking, the UAE is in a distinct position relative to the other Gulf states. And that explains why Iran ended up targeting that country more than others in order to create disruptions for the global economy. But ultimately, leaving OPEC and signaling that it's going to take a more hawkish stance towards Iran moving forward, something that UAE officials have done in recent weeks through their statements, distinguishes the UAE approach from the way that Qatar and Saudi Arabia have tried to, I think, exercise a little bit more strategic patience. Now, I will say that I don't expect the Emiratis to fully try and isolate Iran or to go on the offensive against Iran. We're far from that moment. But nonetheless, something like leaving OPEC, which anyway the UAE was probably considering at other junctures for other reasons, is a way to signal that there's a recalibration underway in Emirati foreign policy and that they're putting their neighbors on notice, including Iran, but also Saudi Arabia and Qatar, that, you know, they're going to have some grievances that need to be addressed in the course of diplomacy that will follow.
Isn't this largely about Saudi Arabia, about UAE and Saudi relations?
I think it is, but I think it's also about UAE-US relations. So, you know, one of the questions that's facing Gulf leaders is, what is the value of the security commitments that the U.S. has provided over the years? What is the value of hosting U.S. bases, buying U.S. weaponry, when at the end of the day, you could neither use your influence in the White House to prevent Trump from entering the war, and when Trump did enter the war, he was unwilling to adequately shield you from the attacks that Iran was perpetrating. So for some of the Gulf countries, this is a moment to say, well, maybe we need to be less dependent on the U.S. in as the kind of pillar of the regional security architecture. Maybe we need to figure out a security architecture for the region where the Gulf states, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Turkey, Pakistan actually come around the table and decide how they're going to address the mutual threat perceptions they have and find arrangements that guarantee their own security. It would seem that the UAE is reluctant to go down that path, largely because it is the Emirate that is, I think, most engaged with the US and also most engaged with Israel. And so it has an alternative. It is slightly differently aligned geopolitically. And, you know, I think the Emirati approach, which is slightly more interventionist than some of its neighbors, is one that maybe sees some logic in how Trump pursued the war, maybe not in how he conducted the war.
Sonja, thank you. I mean, we started this saying that the war was effectively frozen, but obviously there is so much still going on. We really appreciate your insights.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Esfandia.
So, Latika, that was really interesting. I think the regional implications, what's going on with the UAE in particular, is fascinating. But I also think your question to Esfandia about the pressures within Iran and the way in which people are responding to their situation is really critical.
I'm fascinated by this dynamic because if you remember when the full-scale invasion of Ukraine happened, this was the great hope. And there actually were initial signs of protest movements in Russia. And of course, they were oppressed. Of course, any sort of protest was beaten down into submission. And now there has actually been a rallying effect around the flag in Russia by whoever it remains. And I've always been wary about the effect of sanctions for this reason, because bad regimes can use sanctions to say, look, the West is against us. Here is part of our civilizational struggle. Here's why we're different for them. And here's why, blah, 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 you should go and march yourself, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was very keen to try and understand that, because certainly that was the communicated hope of Donald Trump. If there was a strategy or if there was a silver lining that he was trying to project at the start of this war, it was that. And of course, we've seen anything but that take place. So I was very interested to hear that there was a separation and nuance in that rallying effect, that it's for each other and not the regime.
Yeah, I think a study by Columbia University revealed this year that the US had imposed 1,200 sanctions on Iran. And frankly, that hadn't worked, right? So the idea of continuing and increasing, even intensifying that same kind of an economic blockade, one imagines would be really pursuing a policy that's already proven to have been wrongheaded. I mean, if you were hopeful that the Iranians, who were already sick to the back teeth of hardship, would now be even more desperate for a way out, that's not what's being proven. As Esfandia describes it, you know, these are people who know how to endure, and good luck to anyone who tries to wait them out, because on a community level, on a social level, they're not new to hardship or suffering, and they manage. And I thought, related to that, when Esfandia started talking about the political stakes in the US and the idea that those stakes and the resolution of this are actually, you know, higher potentially, more significant potentially for Donald Trump than they are for the Iranians, and that is not something we would have imagined at the start of this conflict.
And yet that's precisely the reason why America, and particularly the Make America Great Again movement, has developed this absolute allergy to conflict, because of this exact fact that wars in the Middle East have a tendency to drag on forever, to use their language. I'm reminded of a comment one Western former general made to me last week, Kylie, where he said, there is no military solution to what happens in Iran. It has to be a political one. And I think that's very much the nuggets of wisdom that were inside that conversation again today. Ultimately, if there cannot be a political resolution here, then the military will grind on, but all we have is potentially a worse situation.
Thanks to our producer for this episode, Jesse Kay, and also Aston Brown for the editing. Now, Hamish and Geraldine will be back tomorrow. Goodbye from us.
See you, Kylie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.